Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Can human beings improve on nature, and should we try? While Americans have objected less strenuously to genetically engineered food crops than people in other parts of the world, many still worry that there is something inherently unwise about our attempts to make plants do things that nature never intended. Horticulturist and writer Noel Kingsbury has a different perspective. Having investigated thousands of years of crop cultivation, he concludes that we've been genetically modifying the food we eat since the moment we turned from gathering to farming, and that the biggest changes to our favorite foods took place before the word gene had even entered the lexicon. His new book is called Hybrid: The History and Science of Plant Breeding. Noel, welcome to Think.
Well, thanks very much for having me on board.
A key takeaway here is that in order to really understand the issues of plant breeding, we need to look at this from a much broader perspective than just what's taken place since the end of the Second World War. Will you talk about that for a minute?
Sure, yes. I mean, our history of modifying plants goes back thousands of years, and very little of what we eat today bears really very much resemblance to wild ancestors. Now, I think a good starting point is the carrot. You know, you go to the supermarket and you buy these nice, big, bright orange, juicy things. But if you were to see a wild carrot, go and dig up a wild carrot, you would think, why on earth would anyone want to eat this? Spindly little white roots with a kind of rather acrid taste. And that separation between the two is quite typical of so much of the foods we eat.
Yeah, if we were to go out in nature, we might not even realize that what we pulled out of the ground had any relationship to what we eat today.
That's right. I mean, and the most extraordinary story of all really is corn, which is so completely different to its wild ancestor that it was only within the last 10 years that the questions have finally been settled about where corn came from. Because Native Americans, thousands of years ago, just recognized a couple of key mutations in wild corn that they collected the seeds and grew them on, and that became the corn that was the foundation of so many Native American civilizations. But it was just a couple of key mutations, but those mutations made the corn plant so, so different to the wild ancestors as to be almost totally unrecognizable, even by botanists.
And they were smart enough to simply take advantage of those and then continue to breed from the mutations.
That's right, yes. And the corn story is quite amazing because of this really big difference. And very early on, several different corn types were developed, and these were then spread throughout the Americas, with the center of variation very much being the Central America, sort of Mexico, Guatemala region. Some went south and were taken up along the Andes, and others went north and were taken up by Native Americans in what is today the USA.
One reason, Noel, that cultivated crops have changed so much is that throughout history, they've received different and highly specialized care. An act as simple as weeding can help with what you call selective breeding.
Sure, yes. What happens is, once people start to cultivate something, that simple act of cultivation changes the plant, because when people go into the fields to collect seed for next year, they fairly obviously go for the best looking pods or the best looking heads of seed, and they collect those. And so there's a selection process, and every year, of course, conditions are different. So if you have a run of dry years, for example, the seed that they collect will end up being more drought tolerant, because those are the survivors. Then, of course, people trade, and people, pre-industrial peoples, will very actively trade seed material. They'll swap with other tribes that they're friendly with, and that brings in more genetic mixing. So there's a constant slow rate of evolution.
And, of course, if you trade with a tribe that lives 50 miles away, the land conditions and the soil and the water might be different, and that causes the plant to adapt in a different way.
Exactly, yes. And sometimes very dramatic things happen, like wheat, for example. Wheat is actually descended from three different grasses, two of them very closely related, and a third perhaps a bit less closely related. And this original wheat hybrid happened thousands of years ago in, we think, the area that now covers Israel-Palestine over to Iraq, the Fertile Crescent, which was really where Western civilization got going, the first cities, the first settled agriculture. And some really key, quite dramatic bits of hybridization happened here, and people recognized that these fatter seeds that sat nicely on the stem instead of falling off were a really good crop to eat. And so we have the beginning of grain-based agriculture in the old world.
Of course, back then, nobody was writing all this down and keeping yearly logs. Can you talk for a minute about how archaeologists and anthropologists determine how and what people ate in prehistoric times?
Well, archaeologists, of course, nowadays go through digs very, very carefully indeed. And any little bit of seed they find is something very, very precious. And we can now use radiocarbon dating very accurately, even on very small pieces of material. So it's been possible to identify it within each layer of the archaeological dig where this thing has come from. It can then be dated, so we can date pretty accurately, but also very excitingly we can now do DNA analysis on these seeds and see how they relate to both to wild relatives, to modern crops, but also to see how they were spread from one area to another.
How did the pressures of growing populations start to force more aggressive efforts to improve plants?
Well, of course, agriculture, once you've worked out the basics of farming, you can feed a lot more people from a small area. The diet isn't necessarily much healthier than the hunter-gatherer diet, and in some ways, arguably, it's less healthy. But you can get you can produce a lot more food, often with more security. And so populations begin to build up, but then you almost inevitably hit limits. The very early civilizations in Mesopotamia, the current-day Iraq, were extremely successful at draining land, taking advantage of the floods of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, and their cities. They were the people who built the first cities in the old world, and they were very, very successful, but population pressure did build up, and then they began to find they were actually damaging their environment with salt deposits that built up with the irrigation. And you have this problem that's being called the Malthusian limit, named after Thomas Malthus, who was really the first demographer in Victorian England, who pointed out that populations rise quicker than the food supply, and that when a society hits that limit, there's a crisis.
What sort of impact did European exploration and ultimately imperialism have on the way we eat?
Well, of course, the people went out from Europe and explored and colonized all over the world, and it was a two-way process. They took their favorite crops with them, which for Europeans overwhelmingly means wheat. And they would start to grow wheat anywhere that had a suitable climate. But also, of course, they took crops the other way. And think about Indian food today. Think, well, how did people in India cope before the chili? The chili is not an Indian plant. It's originally from Mexico. The Portuguese introduced chili peppers to India in the 16th century, and it was taken up very, very quickly. And so this was very much a two-way process. And so very early on, you had these European crops being grown all over the world, and then you had the crops from the Americas being tried out in Africa and Asia. Corn, for example, has become a really, really major, indeed a staple crop over so much of Africa, particularly southern Africa. And it's only been there for a couple of centuries. Before that, people grew completely different crops.
Noel Kingsbury is my guest. He's a horticulturist whose new book is called Hybrid, The History and Science of Plant Breeding. Huge progress in breeding was made during the Enlightenment, and you say that the simple fact that we realized we could improve plants was a breakthrough in itself.
It was, yes. I mean, if you think back to the completely different mindset that people would have had in the 17th and 18th century, that change happened very slowly, so slowly that people didn't really appreciate that historical change was happening, and everything was seen as God-given. And very much in accordance with the Bible, even to the extent that people were very reluctant to eat potatoes at first because there's no mention of a staple root crop in the Bible. And so a lot of people really objected to eating potatoes. But once people started to realize that you could, in fact, improve plants through much better processes of selection, then that was really quite a big sea change in attitudes. And for example, instead of going into the field at the end of the season and collecting a whole bag full of grain to sow next year, just picking out the one head of wheat that is so much fatter, perhaps, than its neighbours, just picking out that one head and sowing the seed from that. So it's real, much more precision breeding. That was the sort of thing that people began to be doing in the 18th century. And this was very much mostly what we call gentleman farmers in Britain and the Netherlands and northern France and Italy. But sometimes the farm labourers were involved as well. And even some very good Victorian wheat varieties were found more or less growing in hedgerows by observant people who then passed them on to larger farmers, perhaps their landlords, who recognised this was a good potential new variety, and off they went. And so yields slowly began to go up.
It is fascinating to think that for the longest time, this was entirely within the domain of farmers themselves. They had the economic motivation to get the best yields and the best products, and so they were the ones who were experimenting, and nobody else really messed with it.
That's right, but I think we have to also look at the social position of farmers, that in many civilizations, farming is not seen as a particularly high-status occupation. And so people didn't actually pay an awful lot of attention to farming until things began to go wrong. And the real change was in the 17th and 18th century, interestingly, in the most densely populated countries in Europe, which were what we now call Holland and Belgium, and Britain and northern France. And this is when, during this Enlightenment period, landowners began to pay a lot more attention to what was happening in their fields. And you had this real passion for farming. And important men in London would have, a country estate. And for the first time, they began to read very seriously the reports from their farm stewards and actually get out there, even got their hands dirty sometimes. to see what was going on. It was this real elite interest in farming that really began to change things.
And I guess it was at that point, Noel, that farmers moved from simply selecting for the best plants to actively trying to breed them. And that was really a sea change.
Yes. Nowadays we take it for granted that plants are male and female and that flowers are basically about sex. I mean, the great Brazilian landscape designer once, Roberto Bulli Marx, once said to me, "Do you realize that when you give people a bunch of flowers, you're giving them a bunch of sex organs?" Well, back in the, until the 17th century, people didn't realize that flowers were about sex and that plants need sexual reproduction to produce fertile seed. Once people realized that there were separate male and female plants to flowers, it was then possible to start crossing. And this, of course, with corn, where you've got this very obvious pollen-bearing male flower on the top and the tassels of the female plant lower down, it's quite easy to see that there are separate male and female plants. And so, not surprisingly, some of the earliest crosses pre-American Revolution happened with corn.
Noel Kingsbury is my guest. He's a horticulturist and an author. His latest book is called Hybrid, The History and Science of Plant Breeding. We'll continue the conversation in just a couple of minutes and invite you to get on the line now to join us. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is horticulturalist and author Noel Kingsbury. His new book is called Hybrid, The History and Science of Plant Breeding. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We have to talk here about Gregor Mendel, who today we call the father of modern genetics. It started for him in the mid-19th century with experiments on pea plants.
That's right, yes. The trouble is we tend to see Gregor Mendel very much in isolation and find it rather odd that a monk, a member of a monastic community, would be doing cutting-level, cutting-edge scientific research. But one of the things I try to draw out in the book is the context that Moravia, which is part of what we now call the Czech Republic, was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and a real center for scientific progress. And you had, I've mentioned the gentleman farmers of England. Well, there were similar people there, that there were people growing fruit, apples, pears, grapes, keeping sheep, growing peas and other vegetables, and really passionately interested in the whole business of agricultural improvement. And so it was a real ferment of what we would today call scientific research, but very much carried on by practitioners. And so Gregor Mendel was very much part of this. And although, unfortunately, a lot of his papers were burnt after his death by members of his monastic order who didn't understand what he was doing and possibly were quite afraid of what he was doing, there is some evidence that Mendel didn't just do experiments on peas, but also did some active breeding of apple varieties.
And it wasn't just the religious community, but also the scientific community that in some cases responded negatively to what he discovered.
That's right. That when Mendel's work was rediscovered some years after his death in 1901, the knowledge of his work was spread very rapidly because of this was at a crucial time. Really, this is when people first invented the word genetics, and so news of Mendel's discovery spread very quickly. But it was taken up very quickly in the United States, much less so in countries in Europe, because people by this time had worked out some pretty efficient methods of improving grain and vegetable varieties, and they didn't really see that Mendel necessarily helped them. And so it took really well until the 1920s, even the 1930s in some countries, before Mendelian methods really were taken up by everybody.
You also tell the story here of the botanist Luther Burbank, and you call him the last great non-scientific, pre-scientific, I should say, plant breeder.
Yes, Luther Burbank is one of those characters, I suppose, that inspired me to write this book, because he is such, unlike most plant breeders, a very kind of shy, retiring type. Luther Burbank was pretty larger than life. And he was a man with clearly enormous energy, but I think the secret of his success was incredible intuition. He was a great believer in Darwin, a great believer in evolution, but he had no truck with Mendel. He simply didn't see how Mendel's genetics would help him. And the way Burbank worked was simply to make a cross, plant out hundreds and hundreds of seedlings, grow them on. And what we think is that he had this very strong intuitive sense about picking out the best. And what was less successful was simply dug up after a year or so, thrown onto a great big bonfire and burnt. And so he was doing industrial scale selection, being very ruthless and but very intuitive. But he was in a way almost a bit too successful for his own good, because he just took on more and more projects, and he himself would never actually grow the products on commercially. He would sell them to other nurserymen to market. And sometimes the marketing that these nurserymen carried on was rather over the top, actually in some cases quite dishonest, and it didn't do Burbank's reputation much good.
Noel Kingsbury is my guest. His new book is called Hybrid, the History and Science of Plant Breeding. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also get to us by sending email to think@kera.org. Let's speak first to Mike in Garland. Hello, Mike.
Hi. I have some quick comments to make about exciting changes on the horizon. For example, the breeding of plants so that they become perennial. You plant your hybrid corn and then just come out and harvest it annually rather than having the extensive replanting of developing tap roots so that the plant can go into the subsoil 6 feet down and pull up water and also pull up the nitrogen that's leaked into the subsoil and then genetically engineering in the trait that legumes have of being able to fix their own nitrogen such that you wouldn't have to put near the amount of fertilizer on the plants that you currently have to do. And finally, 30 years ago, they found a tomato plant growing in a salt spray, and this gene would be very valuable to breeding into plants so that much of the land that's untillable in the world today could then be harvested.
That's really remarkable stuff. Have you heard about any of those, Noel?
Yes, and I'm very glad the listener has brought this up. I mean, the first point he raises about making annual crops perennial is actually something that's very, very interesting indeed. Because if you think about it, most of our important crops are annuals. They're sown in the spring, they produce a lot of seed, which is then harvested in the autumn, and then they die, and that's it. Now, think about the advantages. If wheat were perennial, you wouldn't have to sow it every year. So you wouldn't have to plow. There wouldn't be so much of a problem with weeds. There'd be a lot of advantages to sustainability if wheat were a perennial crop. And as the listener has suggested, their roots could go deeper and utilize nutrients from further down. Now, this business of perennial wheat, it's been lurking around for some time. Back in the 1930s, there was some very, very adventurous plant breeding done in the Soviet Union. And this was before the disastrous takeover of Soviet genetics by Trofim Lysenko, which basically was probably one of the most important reasons that spelled the end of communism in the end. But back in the 1930s, the Russians were doing some really fantastic work, and they were beginning to research this business of perennial wheat. And in the United States, certainly one of the research stations in Washington State, I think in the 1950s, also began to look at this. But then the program was stopped, but I think for funding reasons. But certainly over the last few years, I've, in fact, just at the very last stages of researching this book, I did come across a few more references, again, I think in Washington State, that indicated that people were again looking at this. And this could be a very good development. And of course, the second point is that of salt tolerance. And this is something that is really very important indeed, because in so many countries, particularly drier countries, there are huge areas that used to be cultivated, but because of old-fashioned methods of irrigation have resulted in saline soils. And there's very little you can grow on salty soils. But if we could engineer a gene into plants that enable them to grow on salty soils, that would be a great step forward.
You know, one thing that's really interesting about this idea of making cash crops into perennials is the reality that most research into hybridization and plant genetics is now taking place under the auspices of corporations that stand to profit from selling seed. It would seem that they don't have much financial motivation to sell something one time only to a farmer that otherwise would come back every year.
Yes, and this is one of the issues I touch on the book. In the book, in that plant breeding over the last century or so has, in some countries, it's been very much publicly funded, and it was in the United States for many years. In other countries, it's been very much through private funding through corporations. What happened in the 1980s and 1990s was that public plant breeding, both at home here in Britain and in the United States, was essentially privatized, and big corporations began, which historically had not been involved with plant breeding, bought up the plant breeding research institutes. And there are many people who would argue that this has actually been quite disastrous, because once you get a corporation involved in research, they don't want that research spread to another corporation. So plant breeders then get sectioned off between corporations, as opposed to the whole very collegiate world of science where people share research results. I think things have improved, actually. I mean, I think one of the really positive developments we have now is the example set by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, who are working with corporations such as Monsanto to bridge this public-private divide and putting money into research particularly for the continent of Africa, which has not really benefited from very much cutting-edge research until now, and persuading the corporations that they will have to part with some of their goodies, if you like, in order to invest for the future. Because, of course, eventually, once poor farmers are part of the commercial market, eventually they will start buying the products of modern breeding. But I think there's a recognition that we've got to get over that first step.
Horticulturalist Noel Kingsbury is my guest. His new book is called Hybrid, The History and Science of Plant Breeding. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Doug in Dallas. Hello, Doug.
Hello, Chris. Hello, Mr. Kingsbury.
Hello there.
I'm enjoying this. You're bringing back some old memories of mine when I was a child. Lived in the Midwest, and we used to drive through Iowa quite a bit. And we would see these plots of corn out there, and they had a yellow and green sign on it that said hybrid number so-and-so. And it never really dawned on us that what we were seeing was genetic modification or manipulation or whatever, a la Mr. Mendelssohn, when it comes to a feed crop, a food crop. They were basically trying back then to make the plants stronger, more resistant to disease, increase the yield per acres. And so what was really, I think, taking place back then when I was a child was we had all of this corn in the United States, and that's what we were really interested in, was getting the U.S. crops better and stronger. And one of the things that's happened nowadays, of course, is we're going to the whole world with this genetic modification, whether it's done in the field or in a laboratory, to get these same kind of attributes, as well as growing on land that normally we would not grow crops on, and so on. So it's broadened quite a bit from just a local thing, to me anyway, something
yes.
that is just totally worldwide.
Yes, and I think the period that the listener probably remembers was really from during the 1930s and 1940s, hybrid corn really took off. And this was very much the fruit of Mendelian genetics. The first hybrid corn was developed in the very early 1920s, but it took quite a while for it to become commercially useful, commercially acceptable. But what it gave was, first of all, real consistency, that a farmer could be sure that when they bought a packet of this much more expensive F1 hybrid corn and they sowed it, every single plant would be exactly the same. And this was very important for breeding, in not just improving yield, but for developing varieties that were disease resistant or varieties that were drought tolerant, or, of course, more cold tolerance. And so what you had from the 1930s on was corn moving northwards, that nobody in the 1920s, as I understand it, would have dreamt of growing corn in Minnesota. 1930s onwards, varieties were produced that were much more cold tolerant, that would grow in the shorter growing season you have further north. And this development, all the different corn varieties that had to be developed for each different region of the United States, and then, of course, for overseas clients as well. And there's the enormous success in particular of corn production that actually had quite important foreign policy implications in the 1950s, that the United States was able to produce wheat and corn in a way that communism, which had basically shot its genetics system in the foot, were simply unable to do. And so it was corn and hybrid corn and wheat that, in a way, had enormous implications in helping the West win the Cold War.
Can you talk for a minute about what you mean by F1 hybridization? Because this also plays into some of the concerns people have about losing biogenetic diversity in our food supply.
Yes, an F1 hybrid is, without going into all the details, it's where you cross two distinct varieties and you have then this new variety, which is the first generation. That's what we mean by F1. It's generation number one. And these are very, very consistent. And the parent varieties are chosen for very specific reasons. What happens then if you sow seed from that F1 generation, what you then get is a throwback to the parents. And so you get a mixing up of all the various characters, and so you lose the reason why you buy the seed. So farms would need to come back and buy the F1 hybrid seed every year. And in some ways, this can be seen as a way of effectively patenting the seed. And, of course, it benefits seed producers quite a lot. So there's been, quite rightfully, I think, some suspicion of this. But on the other hand, very often it's possible to produce F1 hybrids with a persistent quality. It is simply not possible to produce through other breeding methods. But, of course, it's very important that we hang on to all the old varieties that the seed producers and seed banks in public ownership hang on to all the old varieties, because you never know when you need to go back to an old variety to perhaps to find some characteristic that is needed, particularly for pest or disease resistance.
Noel Kingsbury is my guest. He's a horticulturalist and author. His latest book is called Hybrid, The History and Science of Plant Breeding. We'll take more of your calls after the break, and do have a couple of lines open if you'd like to join us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email at any time to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is horticulturalist Noel Kingsbury. His new book is called Hybrid, The History and Science of Plant Breeding. Join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. We'll go next on the line here to Bert in Dallas. Hi, Bert.
Hi. Just to get you to hammer on the bioengineering risk a little bit more, it seems to me that there's a huge difference in magnitude between the type of crossbreeding farmers and horticulturists have done for centuries and, you know, taking a fish gene and putting it into a tomato. I mean, you're introducing genes that would never have any way of cross-communicating. And so I'd like you to talk about if there is an additional risk of taking that leap. And secondly, a lot of people seem to think that Monsanto, you already talked about the aggressive patenting that people, corporations use, but it seems that Monsanto has an awful lot of near monopoly power on this, and that could pose a lot of problems too in really assessing the risk and getting the true benefits out of some of this stuff.
Thanks very much for your call.
Sure.
Well, I think one of the things I've tried to show in this book is that whole history of plant breeding. In fact, this was one of the reasons why I wrote the book in the first place, because I wanted to know what the background was during the great debate on genetic modification when it first hit Europe around about 2000. And in comparison to what has happened in the past, genetic modification is actually very, very precise. That's its beauty. You only are moving the gene you want to move. And if you look back at previous methods of breeding, some of them do seem extraordinarily haphazard, and yet there have been no ill effects from any of this. I think very few people these days know about radiation breeding, which sounds really rather terrifying, but in fact has been in many ways very successful. From the 1950s onwards, the seeds would be irradiated using a radioactive source to generate mutations, a higher rate of mutation than you would normally have naturally. And you would have to sow, as Luther Burbank did, thousands and thousands of seeds that had been irradiated to pick out just one or two that had an improvement. Now, radiation mutagenesis causes a lot of what you could describe as random damage to the plant's genetic material. But no harm has ever come out of this large-scale random damage. And in fact, some very good varieties have come out from radiation breeding programs, which are still in use. And it's a very good tool, particularly for developing countries, because it's very cheap. It's effective in countries where you've got a lot of labor who can be used to sort through the seedings. But if you talk to most people now about the process of radiation breeding, it's the sort of thing that makes your hair stand on end, because we're so afraid of radiation. But in fact, it's been completely safe. And I think when you talk, people talk about reading in a fish gene into a plant, a gene is simply a bit of code. It's a bit like a bit of computer code. It's simply an instruction to make a few proteins. That genes, we actually share so many of our genes. We share something like 60% of our genes with a nematode worm. That genes are simply informational material that all of life actually shares and gets swapped around by viruses. So in fact, genetic engineering is not in a way even unnatural, because nature is swapping genes all the time.
Is there a special method of testing things that have been genetically altered?
Well, I think the testing process, which is not something I cover in the book, and this is very much more of the modern material, looks at both the product of the plant, and testing is pretty rigorous, with many generations of plants being tested. But in some ways, this testing process is perhaps too onerous. And one of the problems is that the more thorough a testing program is, the more expensive it is to produce a new variety. Now, if there's no particular reason to believe that anything untoward should happen, if you're introducing a gene that's from a near relative, for example, say within the broader potato family, if we're looking at potatoes, then arguably that's an unnecessary regulatory cost. Now, in thinking in terms of poorer countries who need new varieties and they need them quickly to feed expanding populations, arguably over-regulation is an additional cost that could be a great disadvantage to them. So I think we need to look very carefully at the appropriateness of the testing that's used for genetically modified varieties and target it accordingly.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Denton and speak with Don. Hey, Don.
Good afternoon. I wanted to bring up expound on the perennial plants. If we bred cereal grains, for example, that were perennial, that would mean that a whole lot of the food supply that would normally have grown into grain would have to go into building underground structures to survive over winter. And so you wind up with a significantly lower yield if you do that, which is probably the reason that that the cereal grains and the grain breeders over the decades have not focused on perennialness, because annualness is advantageous when you're looking at total yield.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, I think you're probably completely right there.
We have an email here from Cameron, who asks if you would talk about how you feel about the U.S. Patent Office accepting patents on genetically engineered crop seeds and the effect on farmers.
Well, of course, it's always been it's taken quite a long time for the business of patenting really to be recognized in breeding. That the first Patent Act in the United States was, I think, passed in, I think, around about 1930, but it would apply only applied only to material that was, propagated vegetatively, like by cuttings or division. What we've had from the 1980s onwards is a much greater attempt by corporations to patent the seeds they produce. But of course, at the end of the day, once something is out in the field, it's actually quite difficult to control. And one of the stories I tell in the book is what happened to a Monsanto-produced cotton variety that was introduced to India that was bred to be resistant to the very damaging bollworm caterpillar. And one of the things that always happens at research stations is that people break in and steal the seed because they know that the plants being worked on there are going to be better. And this is an endless problem of theft from research stations. And some of this Monsanto cotton mysteriously disappeared from an Indian research station. And really, in no time at all, this gene was being bred into traditional Indian cotton varieties. And it's actually proved to be very successful because it does render the plants pretty well resistant to this very damaging pest, which enables farmers to use much less pesticide application. But the point of the story was that it was, in a country like India, absolutely impossible to round up the gene once it was out. And it's a story that makes mockery both of companies that try to patent material, but it also makes a mockery of all those people who were opposed to farmers growing genetically modified crops, because here were thousands and thousands of Indian farmers making a decision that they would try this new crop, and in many cases doing very successfully with it.
Let's go next on the phones to Bob in Corsicana. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I'm glad to see that finally someone is getting a public hearing that's reporting some facts and some sanity about genetic modification. I grew up on a farm, and I worked professionally as an agronomist, and the idea that genetic modification is somehow a step backwards is completely false. It's a huge step forward. It's
absolutely
a benefit,
yes,
to mankind.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And back in Bible days, when Jacob manipulated his herd of goats to gain an advantage over his father-in-law, that's an example of genetic manipulation that goes back who knows how many centuries.
Yes. As I've tried to point out in the book, I mean, we've always been at it, and some of the biggest changes, like the changes with corn, happened a very, very long time ago.
What do you think accounts for our discomfort with just the idea of genetic modification?
Well, I think it's partly a matter of timing, that back in the 1950s and 1960s, there was a widespread belief that science was going to solve all of our problems, that nuclear power was going to generate electricity that would be too cheap to meter. And there's that phrase we certainly used here, the white heat of technology. And then things began to go wrong. I mean, nuclear power was a good example, but there were various accidents that it never turned out to be as cheap as we thought it was going to be. Over here in Europe in particular, we've had a number of real problems, BSE disease in cattle, for example, various problems with highly toxic pesticides, very persistent pesticides in the food supply, and the shine rub came off science. And so from the 1970s onwards, I see the general public led very often, I think, by journalists writing for papers who don't really know what they're talking about, really promoting quite a lot of anti-science stories. And so there's now a much wider public distrust of science. And if, like I said, with the radiation breeding, which was really 1950s onwards, if you say to people, look, did you realize in 1956 the Hungarians started eating a type of rice called nuclear rice, and nobody was worried about it, and no one came to any harm. that you have to put everything in a historical perspective. And I think it's just the misfortune of GM technology to have arrived, firstly, at a time when people had been fed a lot of anti-science stories by the press after there had been some real concerns. But secondly, it coincided with the privatization of plant breeding, so that multinational corporations were buying up the plant breeding research institutes. And I think I always say to people, you have to separate the two issues out. On the one hand, there's the technical issues concerning safety and environmental issues. On the other hand, you've got political questions about ownership. Who owns and controls the technology? And once you get people to think of those separately, you can then often bring them round to the idea that GM crops are in fact safe, but perhaps we should be thinking about a bit more public investment in this area.
You write here that the future of traditional crops is brighter than many people realize. What tells you that's true?
Well, there's a terrific, both in the United States and in Europe, there's a terrific interest now in food, in locally produced food, in older varieties, in much more food diversity. We rather reacted against the supermarkets offering us all rather bland material, and that people are getting much more interested in special varieties of food. And so I think there's, in many richer countries, there's a real interest in these traditional varieties. And in some cases, in fact, making improvements to those varieties, growing them in more modern ways, that as we've become wealthier and better fed, we've just got a lot more interested in the variety of food. I mean, just for one example, a grain called Kamut, which I think is produced now in Montana, it's actually a very old Egyptian variety. I'm a passionate cook. I make all our own bread. And people like me will go out and they will buy things like Kamut flour and experiment with using it for making bread. And there's a lot more of us who like to try different things out. And that provides a market for a lot of older varieties that may have disappeared and gives them a new commercial future, I think.
So if we're willing to pay for it, somebody will be willing to grow it.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And very briefly, you write that the future of plant breeding is Creole. In a sentence or two, can you explain what that means?
Yes. Creole, it's a term we use to describe somebody of mixed race or a language that's of mixed origins. I think it's originally an Afro-Caribbean word. It describes that mixing together of the traditional and the modern, just as the Monsanto cotton gene escaped in India and people started breeding it into the traditional Indian cotton varieties. You could say that those new cotton varieties that resulted are a mixture of the high-tech and the traditional low-tech. And it was about farmers and small companies in India taking responsibility, taking decisions themselves.
So sorry, we're out of time. Noel Kingsbury's new book is called Hybrid, The History and Science of Plant Breeding. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Well, thank you. It's been great.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.
This is your source for NPR News, 90.1 KERA, Dallas, Fort Worth, Denton. And online at kera.org. Also, 100.1 K261 CW, Tyler. 88.3 K202 DR, Wichita Falls. And 99.3 K257 EV Sherman. Stay tuned for more Think on your source for NPR News, KERA 90.1.
Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the 35 biggest moments in modern Dallas history. In honor of the 35th anniversary of its existence, D Magazine has pulled together a list of major events in our social, cultural, financial, and political development since 1974. We'll talk with D writers about the folding of the Dallas Times-Herald, school desegregation, Jerry Jones's acquisition of the Dallas Cowboys, and lots more after the news from National Public Radio.